Cultural Natural Resources. It's Thursday, April the 15th, 1999. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on a placeholder bill, Senate Bill 1028. And with that, I'm going to identify that we do not have the amendments that turn this into the bill that it's going to be. And so with that, I will go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1028. I'm going to now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 813. And Brad, tell us where we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 813 is intended to raise funds for state and city parks to acquire additional lands. The bill authorizes the State Parks and Recreation Department and City Parks Department to offer memorial markers for sale. Persons would be able to buy stone or brick markers with inscriptions on them in memory of a deceased person or in memory of themselves. The markers would be placed in an area that had been purchased in whole or in part from the monies raised by the memorial marker program. The cost of the markers would be determined by the park offering the program. And the sponsor of the bill was unable to be here today, John Wolf, but you do have his written testimony before you. And first up to testify, we have Jim Lockwood with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department.
Welcome.
Thank you.
This sounds like some of the ideas we tried last session.
Well, this is one of the less harmless, I hope.
For good bills. What are you talking about?
No comment. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. I'm Jim Lockwood, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. We basically are neutral on Senate Bill 813 from the state park standpoint. If you look at lines 10 through 16 of the bill, it grants us an authority that's more specific than that already listed in lines 5 through 9. We do similar kinds of work under 5 through 9, the lines 5 through 9 right there in subsection 1. So although we don't have any trouble with adding in the more specific authorization that's very expressly stated so that if there's ever any question in the future, it would be quite clear. So the bottom line is it's fine with us. We just don't see the need, but that's up to your judgment. And I don't have any comments on the city piece. That's something that we're not as familiar with.
Any questions? Brad, you had a number. Was that some parks relative to 6,600?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Jim provided me with a draft fiscal impact statement from the Parks Department on the bill.
If you'd like, I can speak to that.
That would probably be the...
Okay, because the issue was you'd have to sell 6,600 before you get enough to even make a small purchase. Now, my question relative to that was, is that, you know, you remember last time, it was all those ODOT pieces of property and surplus that some of them were absolutely parks. Remember we had Marilyn Shannon's Senate Bill 1022 that we were trying to modify in order to get money into that account to purchase those properties. Some of those were transferred pretty cheap, if I remember.
Yeah, I think that in some respects, there are a number of properties out there that you don't have to have $500,000 or $1 million for, and that's true. One of the factors is, in any program like this where you accept donations, is just exactly what will the cost of upkeep and so on as you get the park. Because if you have a memorial marker, there's some implication that you're going to take care of it in perpetuity or whatever, because as future generations come, the people expect to see that it's taken care of in good order. Then also, whatever you purchase is going to have a cost associated with that in terms of care, whether it be simply litter police or whatever it happens to be, depending on the nature of the property. So, yeah, the property, it depends on the nature of just what it is that we would be buying, but it certainly can't hurt us. And, you know, it's an opportunity that's very explicitly stated. And if we, at some point, kind of mount a concerted effort to do this, then we might end up having a real prize in the end somewhere.
Well, you always wonder when you see something like that if the author and the requesting party may have not had a plan, it would be beneficial. And I was sharing with Senator Wilde about one of the folks that works the hallways here a lot was telling me about buying a brick and was referring to this bill. and sent it a notice, you know, that in lieu of your birthday present, I have bought a brick at something or other. I think it was something, Bridge and Staten or something. I think, you know what it was, covered bridge. Anyway, make this long story shorter, the end result was the first thing the kids wanted to do when they got here was to go see the brick. And you know, this can be something, first of all, you want people to take ownership, have an interest in our facilities, and to me, you know, it may be something that works.
Yeah, and that's why we actually currently do that under the subsection 1 there, lines 5 through 9. And the addition here would simply mean that explicitly the memorial purpose could be done as well, and that's why it just carries through the same thought, but more particularly to the memorial part.
Any questions?
Yeah, how much
Senator Fisher.
Land, thank you, Chair. How much land do you already have available for parks? It's my understanding that there's not exactly land short in the Parks Department.
Well, we obviously could. I think that's a matter of perception, Senator. It depends on for what purpose. There's always a new purpose out there and so on. So we're always open to acquiring more. There's more beautiful places along the coast, in the gorge, as Senator George said, a number of places that we're open to. This particular, the testimony by the person that originally proposed this didn't speak to any type of land that would be purchased, but simply that the funding could go toward some kind of a purchase like that.
Senator Fisher,
what ensures the operation of the park after it's purchased by this mayor?
You mean, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, do you mean that if there were sufficient markers sold to acquire other land, what would ensure that it would be taken care of, or what would be done with that?
How would the money be spent, or how would it be funded for its operation?
Well, you're speaking directly to our concern, which is we would have to have a plan that would, in fact, not just purchase the property, but have a plan for maintenance of it if there was any development to be done, whether it be a sign or any, you know, on-through trails or whatever the nature of it would be. We have to have a plan for that, care for that, and so on, and that's why we think it will take a substantial number of memorial markers before you actually purchase the property, have a plan for it, implement the plan so that you care for it in the long run.
Mr. Chair, I don't see anything in here that would forbid any of these units of government from going out and purchasing all of the land they could purchase underneath this kind of arrangement, and then coming back to the people and say, well, we got it, and we've got the markers out there, and we have to promise the people up, keep them, and now we need the money to run the park, and just use it as a come-on for raising taxes and so forth without really any way I can control them.
Okay, thanks.
I think one of the ways this would be controlled, and I don't think you were soliciting this, and the other thing is that it would generate, there is going to be a market limit as which you could charge for the bricks. And what I was just noticing is that you have under your control the designation of the appropriate place and the design and all that stuff, and so you can place this in a way that would be easily maintained and this sort of stuff. So it looks like it has, you know, some real good sideboards on it. And would you like to answer the question based on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, we have the same concern you do. This could be a noose around our neck if people think that, oh, all I have to do is donate this, and so many people need to donate this, and the state parks is going to go out. And I assume that would apply to the city folks down below as well. But if the expectation is there that you know, a few thousand people donate money and we're going to have this new park, we are very concerned that we have a long-range plan for anything we acquire, because we don't want to be in the position of begging or whining or whatever because of something like this. That's why we're pleased that it doesn't say we shall do it. It says we may and lays it out there, because to have it prescriptive would be something that would concern us. this is an opportunity if it's the appropriate time and place, but it's not one that says that we have to do it.
Mr. Chair, for your indulgence, how come counties are remarkably left out of this?
Senator Fisher, I can't speak. I was not involved. We were not involved in any way in drafting this or anything. And that was the question I had as well. There's also special district parks, and I don't know what. I can't speak to that. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, what in state law right now limits you from doing this in light of Section 1, starting on line 5 on page 1?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, nothing.
So in a way, this is superfluous.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, to the State Parks Department, I don't know if there are any nuances to the lower section or not, but there's nothing that I know of that would prohibit us at this time.
Well, it was Mr. Chair, in the testimonial letter here, it was talking about I'm trying to go here through the letter quickly. Pioneer Square, where they said they have already sampled the renovation of the Astoria Column. Pioneer Square.
Astoria Column.
Well, no, but it's got to be on land. Yeah, it's putting that to call it the business district. Their commercial property. How it seems like they actually have the ability to do that right now, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, you're correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many locations have you done this with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, to my knowledge, the only one I can think of was the state park. I may be, once in a while, there's a memorial bench here or there that somebody donates, but we only have one location that I can think of that has a number of names on it, a rose garden where people donate in memory of somebody, and it's inscribed on that plaque.
Certainly, Senator Wild.
Perhaps this is considered to be encouragement that you consider doing this more often. And I know personally, having a young child and the Montessori school he goes to, part of it was paid for using this type of a method. And he loves crawling around looking at all the names. I mean, he spends a great deal of time doing that. And as adults, we tend to forget how fascinating that kind of thing can be. But it is a drawing card, and it gets people to do things that they might not otherwise do or go places that they might not otherwise go. And so it would seem to me this might be strong encouragement that you consider this type of program.
It definitely is, Mr. Chair, Senator Wild. If the type of issue that is kind of in the back of your mind and then it doesn't come to the forefront very often, this brings it to the forefront. And we may take a look at what we do now and ponder alternatives, or if there is a theme here, as the proposer of the legislation said, that maybe more and more people over time would opt for this type of circumstance. Maybe it's certainly something we need to look at and think of for the future. Not so much as we still have the same concern Senator Fisher did, which is just what is the assumption, the expectation of people about purchasing property, but maybe more so for the purpose of having them concentrated in one place, like Pioneer Square or whatever.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher?
I guess I have a concern that you don't have a dearth of land available right now to create new parks on, as far as the state's concerned, at least from my understanding. And to encourage a mechanism whereby land might be purchased. Already got land that would make reasonable parks, have the money, hardly supposedly to fund the ones we I'm not sure I want to encourage property investment. That's the end point.
Let's go ahead, Senator Duke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that that last session, you and I discovered that ODOT has this list of surplus property.
Before you got here.
Did you? Yes. Okay, surplus property, and the law requires that they sell it for the appraised value. And a lot of it is either adjacent to an existing state park, so that development would be detrimental to the park, or it's a unique site. And so there are pieces of property that parks would like to acquire, and sometimes as much to hold them for the time being and stop them from falling into the hands of development as to actually develop a new park.
Probably you go to a work session to discuss that. Do you want to do that? Does it only be if anyone signed up?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say that since we're still in the public hearing on this, that it occurred to me in carrying that speed bump bill today that maybe we could sell speed bumps, like you were going to sit in front of the equipment that, you know, where they were going to set up the prison, and we could have, like, Senator Gary George speed bumps and great use of money for parks. Since you don't want the prison in Wilsonville anyway,
no,
you know.
No, I hate that.
And if we get the prison in Wilsonville, then we can do the speed bumps over in Umatilla.
No, I would buy a speed bump in Umatilla.
Okay. You could put new speed bumps in a park. You could have speed bumps in a park.
He's
right?
Doing this for campaign purposes, you know, because he's going to use that.
He can get a lot of them in Umatilla.
Okay, Jim, you better get out of here. You're going somewhere.
I'm ready. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 813, and I'm going to open a work session on 813. And, you know, I don't like to express my opinion about anything, but I really like this bill. And one reason is what Senator Gooch referred to, and that is there are properties out there. And if I thought some of those properties could be picked up from ODOT, that are particularly like in the Gorge, I would be buying bricks with a little money I have. And so...
Especially if they were on prime farmland.
Prime farmland.
Okay, so let's just see what happens. I'll move SB 13 to the floor with a new pass recommendation, or do you want further discussion first?
Senator Fisher.
I'm basically opposed to this. I don't see any reason for if they're buying land out there on the outside of parks, and have to put a whole bunch of memorials on it when that's not what they're buying it for or maybe even holding it for. That doesn't make sense either.
But you'd vote with me to get this before when you...
No, I wouldn't. That's not ever been my practice as chair, and I don't intend to change now. I'm too old for that. That's my ways. I just have a real problem with creating more than what we already have. The counties are left out of this. Other jurisdictions.
The counties are not going to be able to buy a grant.
I just don't. And I don't see a thing in here to stop them from doing that anyway right now. The law already allows that.
Okay, so I just repeat it for you. Yes. Senator Wilde has moved Senate Bill 813 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further comments or questions?
One comment. I think my arithmetic still tells me that I can written here with the number. I won't measurably affect your perception here.
I know. I appreciate that. So you really are bound and determined to vote no. Okay, subject to no further negotiation, the clerk will call a roll.
Well, even though I risk losing, like, the Bill Fisher Memorial Mud Hole, I'm going to vote yes for this. Yeah. What are you, Irish? Brennan. Yeah, figure. Yeah. Just put yes.
Hi.
Yeah.
even though I risked having to share my poll with Senator Corcoran.
I.
We do not. Due to the fact that we don't have Senator Gertley here, I will be the carrier on this bill, if no one less than someone objects. Would she?
Oh, yeah.
I think she would. All right, what do we do about that?
Just to sign it through.
Just sign it through.
Okay. Like people that don't show up at meetings, you give them pass to do?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, that will be fine. The carrier of Senate Bill 813 will be, upon her approval, Senator Gertley. Okay, I'm going to close the work session. Yeah, did we open a work session on that? We did, thank goodness. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 813, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 940. Brad, tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 940 exempts glass container manufacturers from recycled glass requirement under specified circumstances. Specifically, under current law, glass containers sold in Oregon must be manufactured with a minimum of 35% recycled glass. Beginning January 1st, 2000, that minimum recycled content requirement increases to 50%. Senate Bill 940, sponsored at the request of the Glass Packaging Institute, makes three fundamental changes to current law. It eliminates the year 2000 increase to 50% minimum recycled content for glass containers and retains the 35% level. It specifies that glass containers manufactured outside Oregon are only subject to the minimum recycled content requirement of the state where the containers were manufactured, and it creates an exemption from minimum recycled content requirements for glass container manufacturers who cannot meet the requirement due to technological infeasibility. And first up to testify, we have Liv Anderson with Oxford.
Welcome. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Chair George and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee concerning Senate Bill 940. My name is Lev Anderson, and I'm the Environmental Associate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, otherwise known as OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a nonprofit, nonpartisan environmental and consumer watchdog group for the state with over 25,000 members. Throughout our 28-year history, we have been committed to increasing the efficiency of recycling and limiting the waste of natural resources that occurs with low recycling rates and high volumes of materials going to landfills. Minimum content standards are a key component of ensuring that the maximum amount of recycled materials go into manufactured products. Minimum content standards set guidelines for recycling to guarantee benefits in saving energy and preserving virgin materials. Oregonians overwhelmingly support recycling, and our state programs have been a model for the rest of the nation. SB 940 is an attack on the current recycling laws of Oregon. OSPIRG is opposed to Senate Bill 940, and we urge you, members of the committee, to oppose this bill as well. OSPIRG's three objections to Senate Bill 940 are that, one, it eliminates 50% minimum recycled content goal for the year 2000. It exempts manufacturers who do not upgrade equipment to meet minimum recycled content standards. And Senate Bill 940 allows out-of-state plants to bring lower content products in to compete with Oregon recycling businesses. The first point, SB 940 freezes the state minimum content requirement at 35% and eliminates the goal of 50% minimum content to go into effect in the year 2000. This is a step backwards from the state's goal of increasing the efficiency of our citizens' recycling efforts. 50% minimum content is an economically viable goal with at least one recycling plant, Owens Brockway here in Portland, already set to achieve that goal. OSPIRG remains committed to the state's goal of 50% minimum content because it's vital to preserving virgin resources, reducing energy use, and the production of greenhouse gases, and keeping Oregon recycling businesses competitive in the interstate market. SB 940 also would exempt glass manufacturers from compliance if meeting the requirements is, quote, technologically infeasible based on the existing equipment and manufacturing requirements of the manufacturer. In other words, manufacturers who claim that if they are unable to upgrade their equipment to meet the requirement, they do not have to. This could effectively nullify the purpose of the current law. Manufacturers claiming these exemptions simply, you know, may want to pad their profit by producing low recycled content goods with inefficient equipment. This is unacceptable at a time when, to our best of our knowledge, every glass manufacturing plant on the West Coast, including British Columbia and Mexico, can currently meet a 35% medium content standard, except the Ball Foster plant in Seattle. And I'd also like to add that the state of Washington does not have any minimum recycled content levels at all. SB 940 would make another change in recycling law that Osberg opposes. It says that out-of-state glass plants that ship containers into Oregon need only comply with the standards for the state in which they are operating. If this were the case, Oregon recycling businesses would be hurt by plants like Ball Foster in Washington, where there's no minimum content standard. Here in Oregon, we have some innovative manufacturers who have worked to comply with the state recycling standards that are based on sound science and public policy. These numbers are not arbitrarily selected. To reverse the progress we haven't made in the production of recycled goods, in order to allow out-of-state plants like Ball Foster to take a greater share of the market, would be a blow to our citizens' recycling efforts and our local recycling businesses. In conclusion, I again ask that the committee oppose Senate Bill 940. Let the current minimum content standards work. Do not compromise the ability of Oregon's recycling businesses to compete in the marketplace. I would like to add one other thing. We've just had some discussions with the folks at the Glass Packaging Institute, and we've agreed to talk to them a little bit further. They seem to have some specific concerns with specific plants, and we just find that the language of the bill as it is now is just a bit onerous for those specific cases.
I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly where I was going to go when you concluded, and that was, can you stay through the testimony from the other folks? And what do I want to find out, if there's any way we can work with, you know, when we hear their position and their understanding of where we are with the recycling, possibly to see if we can get together with something will work, if in fact you feel comfortable with the conclusions they draw. Can you go ahead and stay for the...
I can stay in here with them. Of course, you know, we have other people that we'd like to talk to before we came to anything here. I'm sure you're not suggesting that we come to any conclusions here after they speak, but rather just we'll agree to work with them later.
Yeah, we would love to hear from you. What I may do is go ahead and have you maybe respond to this. It'll help the committee as far as direction with the bill.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, Senator Wild was next, and then Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has your organization taken a position on the change in Portland's recycling policies in terms of glass collection?
The co-mingling at the curbside collection. Yes. We think it's imperative to sort glass and also sort newspapers, because when you have companies like Smurfit that want high-quality newsprint, that has to be separated from the paper. And with the glass, it's the same situation. You have a lot of customers that buy the recycled glass, and if you mix the glass up too much, then the quality goes down, and you have less buyers for that. So we support some minimum changes in the curbside collection system, not necessarily going as far as the proposal by the Bureau of Environmental Services, but, reducing the number of sorts, but making sure that glass is, colored glass and clear glass are separated to maintain the quality.
Thank you. And so having said that, even though you need very specific equipment to take mixed glass that a facility may or may not have, you would still endorse Portland's policy of mixing colored and clear glass, knowing that it can reduce the available pellet to some of these plants so that they cannot meet a 50% standard?
First, when I say that, we kind of support the city's plan. We want to make sure that they keep the glass separate, the colored glass separate from the clear glass.
Oh, okay.
So that's our position. So we recognize that that problem. We talked to the folks at Owens Brockway, who is the chief collector of a lot of the Portland glass. And that's kind of the reason why we're concerned about the Portland proposal, advocate that you keep colored glass, clear glass separate.
certainly spend a while.
Because I know, I remember I was on the Commercial Recycling Task Force during the interim, and I remember the testimony saying that if in fact they do mix those, that pellets that really will not be available to them and will probably go to the California market where they are set up to do it. Mm-hmm. And I know some people very callously and flippantly say, well, just change your equipment. Well, that's a sizable investment. And when you've established a plant based on a recycling program of a major metropolitan area, and then they arbitrarily go and change it and just say, well, change your processing equipment. I mean, that the state has to take into account when they create policy. And so I think that's what we're struggling with.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I understand that. I think, like I said before, a lot of plants don't have a problem in meeting the minimum standards. We're talking about one specific plant, so I don't know if we need a statewide law change to address that plant's problems. I think there's other ways to, you know, help them out. So, that's...
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. you made some statements here concerning economically viable situations and so forth. How many years of business experience do you have operating businesses?
Well, not a lot of business experience. I've worked for, you know, different businesses throughout my my young days, I guess. But I've met with recycling business, you know, managers and so on, and talked to them about these types of issues. So, you know, I kind of understand where they come from on some of these issues.
Well, you just stated here it's an economically viable goal. And I'm asking you what you're basing that on, what your opinion is based on where your business experience is to start telling some industry what economically viable is. Maybe you misunderstand, but I've had considerable experience dealing with the likes of you and your Osberg group, where they ought to know everything that every business ought to be able to do at all times and at all seasons and exactly how they ought to operate and everything else, and you haven't had one dime worth, one nickel's worth of any kind of management experience in business. And there's a few of us who get kind of tired of that kind of thing here, and you're making just a flat statement here, and I want to know what you're basing it on.
I'm basing that on conversations with the folks that own Rockway, the chief recycling business here in Portland, that have said they can meet the 50% goal. You know, each individual businesses are different.
I'm not talking about meeting a goal, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about them viably. You said this is a viable economic goal.
Well, they can meet the goal without going out of businesses, basically.
Mr. Chair, that's really great. That's a real consolation. There's a lot of things that the person...
And they can maintain profit levels as well. I mean, to make sure that they...
Well, I think that I could probably get an entirely different feeling from Owens Rockway where I'd go up to spend an hour or two with him. But anyway, that's about what I expected, was that this statement's made without much experience and not a background of having had a dollar invested in a company yourself or being involved in losing your own shirt or having to face employees with cutbacks and all that kind of thing. And there's just a few of us around here getting a little tired of that kind of thing being placed on people. There's an educational process that's gone on that's got people to know a lot about using these things and what they can do. I think my colleague from Portland made a pretty good assessment of the fact that here's a city just sitting here and blasely saying they can go along and keep doing this thing when they're not willing to put themselves out to see that it goes. They want their cake and eat it, too. It's not the first time we've experienced that kind of an attitude from the city of Portland and others. It just bothers me. These people are using this. Why not give them a chance to get some kind of an idea that they're willing to go ahead with this? If it's economically viable, they won't want to quit it. They can go ahead with their profit margin and make it on it. They're not going to be interested at all in stopping this process. It bothers me because you guys registered in basically on that kind of the side of the issue 99 times out of 100. I would have to say that one time you surprised me, but I almost died over shock too. But this type of thing of saying when you don't have a dime invested in somebody else's business, what they can do economically viably, just doesn't cut it with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Nelson and Tom Mabee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the Glass Packaging Institute. With me today is Tom Mabee, also representing the Glass Packaging Institute. I'd first like to say that we have worked on this legislation now for two sessions, and we've made progress each of those two sessions and have worked with DEQ, Augsburg, and other Recyclers Association in trying to reach compromise. And at the beginning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that we have some room here to reach some compromise, and would like to request, a couple of days to try to reach that agreement and come back before you and hopefully have something that that everyone can live with. But as has been indicated, the bill offers several amendments. We reduce we eliminate the 50% requirement and keep it at 35%, and there are a number of reasons for this, Mr. Chairman. The first, as has been indicated in the case of Owens Brockway, they are over 50%. They have been, I think, the darling of glass manufacturers in the state in terms of their recycled content. Everything left alone, they would continue to be over 50%. The problem, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is, as Senator Wiles has indicated, the city of Portland is looking at going to a co-mingling. If that occurs, Owens cannot meet the 50%. And we believe that is what's going to occur. And so that's one reason to reduce to 35%. Another reason is that the only other state that has the recycled content requirement, which is California, did have a 50% requirement in the statute, just like Oregon. They, about 4 years ago, eliminated that, and they, all of their eight plants are at 35%. So we want to conform with California, who are shipping empty vessels into the state, and so we believe that that's why we're matching the 35% to the 35%. We also in here, of course, try to deal with those manufacturers who are on states that don't have a recycled content law. And this can be, for example, Oklahoma. Again, we get most of our empty containers from Washington and from California, but we do get some containers coming into Oregon manufacturers from other states such as Oklahoma. They would be lucky to be at about 18 to 20%. If they don't have the recycling infrastructure and the availability of cone, to reach that percentage. So we need something to make sure that those people, even though they are increasing their use of cullet when it's available, have an out for those containers that come into this state. And that's why you see the amendment that says that they must demonstrate to the satisfaction of the department that the manufacturer meets the minimum recycled content requirement of the state where the containers are manufactured. Finally, in lines 24-25, we have an exemption for meeting the minimum percentage requirements for those that are technologically infeasible based upon the existing equipment and manufacturing requirements for manufacturing. This is, as has been mentioned, is aimed at the Ball plant in Seattle. And Tom can give some more of the technical issues there, but they primarily make what's called dead leaf green, which is the glass that goes into the Chardonnay bottles that goes to Dundee and McMinnville and Newburgh. It is a very, very difficult color to achieve chemically. They have four plants, four gas-fired furnaces, excuse me, and one electric furnace. The electric furnace can't make because of its configuration. And because of the way it works, to not do the dead leaf green. And they're also prevented from the electric furnace was required to avoid further emissions by their equivalent of the DEQ. So because of the dead leaf green, which they principally produce, we cannot make that and have them even correct the color. There is no mechanism to correct dead leaf green color. So it's very difficult for us to then have color. We can correct some of it in combination with other colors, but the use of the recycled color is very, very difficult. So technologically, we have problems in that one particular fall plant, and Tom can expand a little bit more on that. And that's an overview of why these amendments are here. If not, you can't just say all the plants are the same, because they're not. Owens Brockway exists in Oregon under the Oregon Bottle Bill, under the recycling program of Portland, which is about to be changed, and they have certain needs and certain requirements. We have the California plants, we have the Seattle plants. So that's why we bring you this mixture of amendments.
Can I ask one question here? And I look at the letter from the city of Portland, and it appears from what you're saying that they've helped to create maybe one of the problems or the reason you might have to go down in a quantity. But again, at the same time, they write in here blasting the bill as gutting the Oregon requirements. And it helped me to understand this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's very difficult to understand. This is, and I want to say this on behalf of DEQ and Osberg in this particular case, is they have, with Owens Brockway and the Glass Packaging Institute, fought the city of Portland on the commingling proposal. And so in that particular case, we all joined together. And quite honestly, the city has joined with the haulers to further this proposal. It will save a lot of money, but the money and the recycling in terms of Oregon and Owens Brockway will be hurt.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, you see, this is interesting to me because the portion of the Osberg letter that I quoted, which is on the back of the second page, the top paragraph about it being an economically viable goal, turn right around, and this premise of the paragraph prior to that, talking about other states shipping in things that they couldn't compete with, tells me right off the bat that this economic viable goal is about as sensible as absolutely nothing. It's really interesting here, and I agree with you, and I think, yes, I can say that if you're going to demand recycling, that we ought to oppose co-mingling and stuff like that that cuts down to the point that we jeopardize people's ability to get the material. And when you're talking about an expanding market with lots of things on the shelf, and talking about doing 50% recycled product, when there's a good amount of that product, from my understanding, that in the process of making cullet, there's an awful lot of pieces that are too small. The dust from the glass, the tiny pieces and things like that don't fit the need for what cullet is all about. That's the fact that anything that gets lost in the process or mixed up or contaminated, looks to me like going to have to produce glass containers that you go out and break just to recycle enough to get your 50% anyway, just from the law of diminishing returns that you have from the stuff that doesn't come back and the stuff that stays on the shelf and in the process of the shipping and everything in order to meet your demands. And I think, again, that just brings out how little forethought there's actually put in some of these goal-related forced options on people, naturally on Brockway. How are they going to complain about it? They're lucky to be here, able to do business anyway, probably. Why don't we have any other glass plants in the state? You might guess they don't want to come in here and operate under this kind of a ridiculous rule. And it's just very obvious if you're worrying about having our people having to compete and you're saying it's a real thing. He's admitting it in here by his testimony that he's afraid of what's going to happen from other states to come in and compete with our own people, and yet he's willing to hammer away and cause our consumers to pay more and cause our people to have to be able to be less productive and less competitive on the market. Which means less jobs overall and all this kind of thing into our economy for basically no good purpose. And we have the biggest metropolis in the state trying to limit the abilities we have of dealing with this kind of thing. I guess just a
irate that we don't allow people to have an opportunity to do it in a way that they know how. So help me, the city ought to be behind it. They ought to be making that stuff available to them, and they call it out of every most reasonable possible way they can if they want. In fact, we'll reuse, not standing in their way, and we shouldn't be forcing limitations on them that don't allow them to compete with other people and take us out of the market just because they can do it. And still maintain the proper same business doesn't mean that it's in any way a profitable enterprise. That's my reading of it. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, no. And it's, again, as we've indicated, we have obviously seen two serious problems with the city of Portland's direction and proposal. Again, we...
directions and proposal. I just have serious problems with
And again, as this has been fashioned, we're trying to address those issues that we identify both within and without the state, outside the state.
Senator Wilde?
Thank you very much. Actually, in hearing that they teamed up with the Hollers, it's not a great surprise, having the unfortunate experience of living there. I will say that at a time when most of the country was going from franchise haulers to competitive hauling, the city of Portland went the exact opposite and went from competitive to franchise, specifically so that there wouldn't be a great deal of competition. And so it does not surprise me in any way whatsoever that they would take the hauler's side of this. And we've just been discussing behind the scenes the possibility of amending this bill to require that the city of Portland sort their glass according to color. And I think that would be a very appropriate and reasonable addition to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first thing I want to do is extend greetings from Tom Carnahan, the plant manager of Portland, who unfortunately could not be here today. He had intended to be here but was unavoidably detained, as proof of the fact that they're not concerned about the Seattle plant being able to take unfair advantage of Portland. Owens fully supports this bill, as do the other members of the Glass Packaging Institute. I want to emphasize that it is unfair to point to the Seattle plant and say that this is all about an exemption or an exception for a single plant. That is not what this is about. We are concerned about being able to make 50% at the Portland plant in this state in the upcoming years due to the degradation of the quality of the color that is anticipated to be received. Also, the state of California, the comparable organization over there to the DEQ in the state, has already concluded that it would be impossible for the plants in the state of California to meet 50% because of the number of plants there, the amount of color needed between those plants and the fiberglass industry. They suck up all the color. There's not, in fact, Oregon sends color to California and is used to make glass containers and fiberglass in California currently. California is a net importer from this state because they need the color to meet their 35% minimum content in that state. Now, when you get to states such as Minnesota and Oklahoma, which do export empty containers into this state, they simply do not have the recycling infrastructure. And no matter how you apply the law, they are not going to be buying empty containers from the state of Oregon to meet their requirements. They'll be maybe buying containers if we force them to comply with this law from their neighboring state. It will do no benefit for the local communities here in the state of Oregon. I can also represent to you that Owens Portland plant has no intention, if this law is enacted, of reducing its efforts of using recycled content. It will continue to be the good corporate citizen it has been. It has no intention, as long as the quality of pellet remains usable, they will use as much as they can. Why? Because it is in their economic interest to use pellet to the maximum extent possible. You can run furnaces at a lower temperature. That means you use less energy, you spend less money on energy, and your furnace life lasts long. You don't have to rebuild them as frequently. For the same reason, all of the other plants on the West Coast, including Ball Foster in Seattle, would love to use pellet at a greater rate than they currently do. The plant at Ball Foster has for years offered a scrap price per cullet that is nearly three times that offered in the state of Oregon by the Owens plant. And that's because they simply don't have the infrastructure in the state of Washington that you folks are fortunate enough to have here, although that infrastructure is threatened right now here. The price being offered by Seattle plant is comparable and in some cases higher than offered in California. And so it's not a matter of that Seattle plant not trying to obtain the cullet. It is a matter of the cullet not being available and a matter of technological infeasibility. That plant is unique in that 61% of its output is dead leaf green. Dead leaf green can only use a very small percentage of recycled content and still maintain a customer accepted color. The color range is very, very thin, and customer rejections are a real problem with dead leaf green. If you can't sell it, there's no point in manufacturing it. And they used to not have as much of a problem a few years ago, but they lost an amber contract to the plant here in Oregon for beer. Amber is very easy to make at 50, 60, 70% the beer containers recycled content. When you lose that contract up in Seattle and it comes down here, your numbers look very, very bad by comparison. But that plant is unique because of its customer base, which requires the dead leaf green containers. And that is the reason that we've asked for the technological feasibility exemption. And we urge you to support this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Now, that's an interesting thing. So we have fiberglass manufacturing competing with glass manufacturers for recycled glass in the form of cullet. Is that a requirement of fiberglass, or is that, again, just much easier for them to use, having a already refined glass product available to them to use, or is it impossible to make fiberglass from raw materials?
No, it is. It is very possible to make fiberglass from raw materials. They have always used some amount of recycled product. It became a requirement in California only. That is the only state I'm aware of that has recycled content. Plants in California are required to use either 20 or 30%, depending upon which, there are two different rules, and it depends on which rule you fall under. Having said that, the plants that started this off now use greater than 30% because they have found it economic to do so. And so they do compete with the container manufacturers for the cullet.
Senator Fisher.
So again, this makes it even worse than my theoretical explanations when you've got large amounts of cullet being siphoned off into something that doesn't even make glass containers. So you're really facing a problem where I would say somebody somewhere ought to be waking up and saying people have learned and educated themselves in the use of glass, recycling and reuse, and we've proved our point and stopped hammering away and beating people to death for an unattainable goal.
That's exactly true. The unfortunate truth is that the situation in Portland is not unique to this state. It is happening in California and throughout the country. We have seen over and over again municipalities go from color sorting to mixed sorting, and yet they keep the pressure on private industry to recycle at a high rate. They want to treat, if they treat glass as a commodity, the glass industry is thrilled to use it at very, very high numbers. But if you treat reused glass as garbage, we can't use it at all. And yet that's what we are expected to do, because with the collection practices, not just here in Oregon, but throughout the country, with the waste haulers, what has happened is that they throw it all in one big pile. It gets mixed in with porcelain, with plate glass. That stuff sinks to the bottom of our furnaces, and we lose furnaces. That's millions of dollars down the drain, just because a few stones of porcelain have gotten into a load that you miss in inspection. The practices have gone down, and California is going to have a tougher and tougher time meeting 35%, not just 50%.
I'm very interested. What does this actually do to your furnace? You say you lose them, and there's now what does it do?
It destroys the furnace. What happens is the porcelain melts at a different temperature than the container glass, and so you end up at the bottom of a pool with an insulating layer of porcelain, that forces you to have the furnace up at a very, very high temperature. Eventually it burns out, or you get a hole at the bottom and you lose your furnace. Then you have to rebuild, and you lose the production for the month or 2 months that it takes to turn around the furnace.
Okay, everyone, I'm going to just temporarily close the public hearing on this. If you folks would stand by, we're going to lose Senator Farioli in just a little bit, and so we want to deal with another bill. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 940, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1212, 1212. Brad, tell us about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1212 restricts the sale of unpasteurized milk, fluid milk, or dairy products. Currently, it is legal to sell unpasteurized milk from cows and goats. The State Department of Agriculture issues licenses to producers of unpasteurized milk. Introduced at the request of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, Senate Bill 1212 is intended to protect public safety. In the past, E. coli poisoning has been linked to ingestion of unpasteurized milk. According to the Dairy Farmers Association, there are no longer any licensed producers of unpasteurized cow milk doing business in Oregon, and there is only one goat dairy selling unpasteurized milk. And first up to testify, we have Dave Nelson and Don Leeson and Ralph Stake.
Okay, you folks, we have 14 minutes here or less, and so I looked at the list and everybody's for it. And we're going to lose Senator Farioli, so I'll let you use discretion on how fast you go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Nelson of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. We appreciate you introducing Senate Bill 1212 on our behalf. There are two amendments before you that deal with two separate subjects. The Dash 1 amendment exempts goat dairies out of the bill. And we have no interest in goat dairies, and there's one goat dairy that's remaining, and we have no interest in addressing that problem. The Dash 2 amendments are directed at conforming Senate Bill 1212 with the bill, Senate Bill 234, that you have already passed and is preceding this bill through the process. Those are legislative council amendments that conform Senate Bill 1212 to Senate Bill 234. Other than that, we don't want to belabor the process and we'll be going to get in the way of a potential positive vote on the bill. With me is Don Moisen and Peggy Kern. Don Moisen is the legislative chairman of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, who I'm just now going to tell, just say I'm for the bill. And Peggy Kern, who is the marketing director of the Oregon Dairy Products Commission.
No, Dash. Help me out here, Brad. Right now, Dash 2 eliminates the need for Dash 1.
That's correct. Dash 2 accomplishes the same purpose mm-hmm. as Dash 1, but Dash 2 was recommended by Legislative Council to avoid conflict with an earlier bill we passed out of committee, which was Senate Bill 234, the frozen dessert bill.
Senator George, members of the committee, my name is Don Moisen. I'm a dairy farmer from Kaiser, just 2 miles west of Brooks. Our industry has been looking at this type of legislation for several years, and I'll just make a quick comment. In the years past, we've had some bad press on contaminated raw milk, and we're wanting to close the door on that type of a thing, and to hope you'll support it. Thank you.
Senator George and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I am the marketing director of the Oregon Dairy Products Commission, which is a producer-funded organization. I'll make two really brief points. We want to be able to encourage and deserve consumer confidence in Oregon dairy products. 2 points I would like to make is that right now, with the possibility that raw milk can be sold for consumer consumption, we can't completely be able to promise consumers a safe product in unpasteurized milk. And for this reason, major retailers such as Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Albertsons will not sell raw milk and have not, in some cases, for almost a decade. The other point I wanted to make is that in situations where the Thomas Dairy in Tualatin in the mid-90s had an E. coli contamination of the raw product that they were selling for consumer consumption, it had an adverse effect on retail sales of the whole milk category. One dairy cooperative actually reported that their suppliers canceled orders for milk. They did not have the consumer consumption at the retail level, and more milk had to go into powder simply because of the negative ripple effect into the whole market because of what happened with raw milk, which actually represents a very small percentage of milk that's available for consumer consumption in Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Peggy Paul, Oregon Dairy Products Commission. Also, could we get Dr. Paul Kreshak, Oregon Health Division?
Yes, everybody's in favor.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Peggy Paul, registered and licensed dietitian and director of Nutrition Education Services, Oregon Dairy Council, and I will condense my thoughts to a couple of key points. Most reputable health organizations.
Yeah, I object to the use of the word condensed in connection with the milk bill.
If the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Dietetic Association, the American Medical Association, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services all say, choose pasteurized milk, do not buy raw milk, I think the state of Oregon needs to follow suit. Secondly, from a nutrition standpoint, pasteurized milk is the most safe and most superior in nutrition quality. Pasteurized milk is required to have vitamin D added. Unpasteurized milk is not. Vitamin D, though it's known as the sunshine vitamin, in Oregon, we can't rely on sunshine to get vitamin D. We need to get it from pasteurized milk. We need to have pasteurized milk. We don't need raw milk on the market.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul C. Black, and I manage the communicable disease program at the Oregon Health Division, which tracks the spread of communicable disease in the state. I, too, will try to limit my remarks. What I'm here to tell you is that 100 years ago, people in this country, doctors noted that a lot of diseases were being transmitted by raw milk. In the testimony that I hope you've received, I list at least 12 examples of diseases that have been transmitted by raw milk. Despite the fact that virtually probably 99% of the milk in the country is pasteurized, we still have lots of recent examples of outbreaks that have occurred from the roughly 1% of people who drink unpasteurized milk. I've attached several papers to my testimony. This paper documents dozens of outbreaks that occurred over a couple of year period in the United States in association with raw milk. This paper from the New England Journal of Medicine documents a large outbreak of a disease called listeriosis that affected mostly pregnant women and their babies and resulted in 48 deaths in Los Angeles back in the mid-1980s from eating cheese that was made from unpasteurized milk. And finally, this paper, again from the Journal of the American Medical Association, documents Campylobacter outbreaks. This is a cause of diarrhea. More than a dozen of them that occurred over a 10-year period in the United States among children who visited dairies while on field trips from school. So just that group alone accounted for over a dozen outbreaks in the United States. We've had several outbreaks in Oregon, outbreaks of Campylobacter infection in kindergartners in Douglas County back in 1996 from visiting a dairy. We've had an outbreak of E. coli 157 infection in the last few years and salmonellosis. So it affects not only people in the rest of the country, but in Oregon as well. I'm here to tell you that pasteurization, which raises the temperature of the milk to the point where it will kill these pathogens, is an effective means of producing these, and urge your support of Senate Bill 1212.
We've been listening to commercials on the radio. Senator Wyden.
Just one brief question. Is this bacteria present in the cow and travels out with the milk, or does it come in contact with the milk afterwards, and because it's not pasteurized, it then causes the difficulty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, thanks for the question. Both. Some of the pathogens come from the cow. If the cow gets mastitis, that's an infection with staph that is within the cow and then comes out. I think a bigger problem nowadays is insufficient cleaning of the teeth. And we all know that, you know, as I mentioned here, milk does come from the underside of a cow. Cows are lying down in a field, and they get fecal material on them, and that typically is what we're going after.
particularly if there's been geese grazing up. Okay, thank you very much.
Now, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator Fisher.
You say you're in charge of the program for these, or whatever they are.
For Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, for investigating communicable diseases in Oregon, yes.
Do you also have responsibility for hepatitis C?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, yes, that pathogen is under my purview.
How many people in comparison in the states that have the E. coli problem with milk wind up? How does that compare with the number of hepatitis C?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, the number of cases of hepatitis C in Oregon are not known with precision, but our best estimates suggest that 1 to 2% of the population is infected with it. Hepatitis C would overwhelm the problem of E. coli and raw milk.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator,
I perceive that you're spending quite a bit of time on this particular issue, and I'm a little disturbed at what I hear about how much time you're actually spending and how much follow-up and care you're taking to see that hepatitis C is being.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, hepatitis C is a very complex issue that we are struggling with how to deal with it. We frankly don't know how to handle the problem, how to identify the cases best. We were asked to review this particular bill and comment about whether we thought it would be a good idea, and despite the fact that what we're doing for hepatitis C is probably not enough, and we wish we knew how to do better with it, we still support Senate Bill 1212.
Mr. Chair, I know some things happen almost with fine precision. As I walked into this room being advised for the meeting tonight, being advised about the hepatitis C problem, probably you'll be able to handle it first as well. Use this vehicle to find out a little bit more on my patient and have some basics.
Senator Fisher, I'll try to make myself available.
Pardon? Do you have a card with you?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, for using your committee as a...
Hey, we can use wherever they go. Why not that? Secretary, are you okay for a few more minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm anxious to see us move this bill.
Chuck Craig and Ron McKay from Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Craig, Assistant Director for the Department of Agriculture. With me is Ron McKay, the Administrator of our Food Safety Division. We have written testimony that we'll leave with you, and rather than try to repeat in our own words the testimony and the information that Health Division has already provided, suffice it to say that we support this effort to further restrict the sale of raw milk, and we support the bill.
Thank you, Jim.
Floyd Bodyfelt.
I'm Professor Emeritus from Science at Oregon State. I also am a technical advisor to the Tomatarian Cream Association and I'm a consultant in food safety.
Just a moment. State your name for the record?
Oh, yes. Floyd Bodyfelt. I'm very much for this bill. We in Oregon are probably only one of now 13, maybe 12 states that still permit sale raw milk. It's certainly a bill that will let health officials sleep better at night and on weekends. If there's the opportunity for input, I could, as a technical person, probably make some suggestions on maybe some helpful revisions in the housekeeping matter on page 4. Item 4, where it talks about accepting cottage cheeses. And what it's speaking to there is that when you have cheeses in the area of cheddar cheese that are 39% less moisture, you have a public health safeguard by aging that cheese for 60 days at a temperature above 35 degrees Fahrenheit. Then in that period of time, you have...
Were you referring to Dash 2 amendments or to the bill? What do you say, page 4?
Well, it's the page 4 on my fast copy. Paragraph 6, item 4.
Does it say dash 1 on it? Or?
I don't have that current version where I have the dashes in somewhere. So we probably are talking about different pages. But what I'm talking about basically is that I would maybe tighten that a little bit, certainly to accept cottage cheese, which is 80% moisture. Then we have this cheeses that are in the middle ground, like Jack cheese and some other cheeses that are high in moisture content. And I would maybe think that any cheese in excess of 39% moisture would be added to the category of cottage cheese as being one that should be made from pasteurized milk. Then we have the big category of cheddar cheese, which by law tends to be less than 29% moisture. And we have the fact that that cheese is aged for 60 days, 35 degrees Fahrenheit, and a combination of factors, reduction in pH, salt content of the cheese, reduction, oxidation potential change, and competitive microflora. And this is important and essential in the making of many high premium cheeses in the country, including Tillamook cheese and other cheeses where they use today a flash heat treatment and abide by the 60 days of aging above 35 degrees Fahrenheit. But I think there's concern about this middle category, say, of Jack cheese and cheeses that would be above 40% moisture, certainly above 39% moisture, in the same category as cottage cheese.
Do you have that in writing, or could you prepare?
I do have that in writing here.
What I think we'll do, as a relatively minor change, we'll go ahead and move this bill, and then if we get that to Brad, we will relay that to the House as something they may want to consider as they deal with the bill.
One more thing, okay. Senator George and committee members, I added to this and failed to mention it, unsalted cheeses. Sometimes you have cheeses that are unsalted, and the matrix there also makes that more vulnerable. And generally those cheeses are higher in moisture. So combination of being unsalted, being a cheese like cottage cheese, and having higher than 39% moisture would be a concern if not made from pasteurized milk.
Sure. For sure.
Can those cheeses be made reasonably from pasteurized milk?
They can be, but you would change the entire flavor profile. If so, there are cheeses like Swiss cheese and blue cheese in the United States that experience at this time demonstrates that they need to be made from flash heated milk, which is milk just below the pasteurization temperature, or in many cases from raw milk.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm a bit confused. You're saying that we ought to consider that above 40%. Moisture content and no salt or the salt.
Oh, the two concerns we have, yes.
But you say that they can't be made basically out of pasteurized milk.
Well, I'm saying the cheeses that I would put in that category, Senator, would be cheeses like Swiss cheese, certain mold ripened cheeses, and cheddar cheeses when they have a certain flavor profile. They are all below 39% moisture and abide very well in terms of the safety factor of having the requirement of 60 days aging and always at a temperature above 35 degrees Fahrenheit, because you need this activity of the enzymes and the salt and so on in the competitive microflora. If you froze this cheese or had it at a temperature below 35, you wouldn't get that activity. So a very important part of this requirement is that the temperature be aged at a temperature above 35 degrees Fahrenheit, so you have a certain degree of biological activity going on in the cheese, and then a certain amount of time to accomplish this, namely the 60 days.
Mr. Chair, I'm still confused because you said that some Jack cheeses and things like that that rise above the 39% moisture, and you said that if they were made out of pasteurized milk, that they would, it would change their whole.
No, I did not have Jack cheese in that category. Jack cheese is a very mild flavored cheese, and that should always be made from pasteurized milk.
Okay, so the things that you're talking about there, the unsalted and this kind of thing, are made anyway with the...
They're already being made.
And they can be made. It's not an impinging.
But by writing this law, we might as well cover all potential concerns down the road from a public health standpoint and try to exclude those cheeses above 39% moisture and require they be made from pasteurized milk. Because they're in a category like fluid milk. As far as a safety standpoint.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1212, and I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 1212. We'll be dealing with the dash twos, if that is the will of the committee.
I shall remove the dash two amendment to SB 1212.
Okay, without objection, so moved.
I would move SB 1212 as amended for the Duke House recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved Senate Bill 1212 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Bill is passed. Who would like to carry this? Senator Perioli will. All right. I don't want you to do anything like this. This is past your eyes, no. Okay. Okay, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1212. Did I ever do that? We'll do it again. And I'm going to open a public hearing, reopen a public hearing, on Senate Bill 940.
Bob Danko, Department of Environmental Quality.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. For the record, the department is opposed to the bill as written.
Would you say that a little closer, Bob?
For the record, the department is opposed to the bill as written.
Opposed to the bill?
Opposed to the bill as written. This process reminds me a lot like the process we went through last session, and I anticipate we can reach agreement with the bill's proponents and come back with a consensus approach. I guess I'm a veteran of this discussion, as I was around in 1991 working for the department when we first talked about this and placed it into the state law. We dealt with Mr. Nelson in 1995. We worked with him last session on what we thought were amendments that would permanently fix the concerns he had. In fact, I've gotten to know Mr. Nelson quite well through this process over the years. Last time in 1997, We included in the consensus bill, the fix that we're talking about last time, a provision that says if the cullet isn't available, then the percents don't apply or won't be enforced. And that's very important for this Portland discussion. In fact, in looking at it from our angle, and that's why we'll talk it through with Mr. Nelson, the bill itself, we don't think is needed, but your amendment talking about Portland brings in something else that I think definitely needs to be thought through, because that is going to be a real problem. And even though it won't be a problem for the plants because the cullet won't be available to them the way they need to have it come to them.
If Portland continues
on right, if Portland continues on the path it's going, the cullet won't be available to Owens Brockway in the way they need it to make new containers. That's going to, even though Owens Brockway won't suffer the consequences because it's not available, we all suffer. So that amendment should be discussed. I'm glad the committee is going to think about that.
Is there any way that you can see that it could be written, despite the fact that the bill will probably come back with an amendment requiring Portland to sort, because I'm not happy about this letter, and but beyond that, is there any way that you can see a provision that is going to be written that would allow for the adjustment of these numbers based upon action of cities like Portland, if in fact some conditions change, so that you could in fact have the authority to make those adjustments? Because, you know, we're putting a tremendous burden, maybe a competitive disadvantage, on Oregon companies, and I'd like to see this kind of balanced out a little bit, saying we're going to have to adjust to the markets, particularly since the cities may in fact have a major impact on them.
Mr. Chair, I understand what you're saying. I think the availability language that's in the law now addresses that, but you know, we can think that through and with Mr. Nelson and make sure that the competitive thing about Oregon companies is something that we speak for, even though Owens Brockway doesn't say it, because I think the glass industry rightfully sticks together on something like this, and you're not going to get one glass plant saying something that isn't right for the other glass plant. We understand that. Owens Brockway, to their credit, over the years, and like I said, I've been involved with this a long time, they have spent, they have made the investments to be able to handle lots of recycled glass. and they deserve lots of credit for that, and we've given them lots of kudos for that. But they've done that, and competitors of them, they won't say this, but I will, probably haven't made the same investment. And Owens Brockway really, if you step back and take a look at it, again, they won't say it, but they really are at a competitive disadvantage against their competition. And they've stepped up to the plate. And over the years, we've been very happy with them. And as Mr. Nelson said, in the City of Portland discussions, Owens and we and others have seen it the same way. Owens Brockway has made the investments, and their competition maybe hasn't. And that's what a lot of this discussion is about.
What about the issue of Ball Foster Plant in Seattle producing the specialty glass at Emily Green?
Mr. Chair, I've been to that plant, and I've been shown the problem by Ball Foster, and we looked at that after last session. It is a unique problem, although we have conflicting information. We have heard that other plants that handle dead leaf green can use more recycled content than Ball Foster does.
And so why we're determining that, what I'm worried about is we're affecting a growing Oregon industry who is depending upon that and probably would have an effect upon their retail sales if, in fact, we kind of go into a store expecting a certain thing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I think that the deadly screen is worth looking at, and that's something we're going to end up discussing with Mr. Nelson. The way the bill approaches it now is sort of let's not have anything apply. And I think hopefully what will turn out is they will come forward and say, yes, we can do some things and get us close. We may not go get all the way, and then we can talk that through and see if we can reach agreement.
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
How much cola is laying around available and stockpiled?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher. Owens Brockway, for instance, used to have a big stockpile of green glass, and that was a real problem on how to get rid of the stockpile of green
glass. I'm just talking about this clear glass. I'm talking about this. It's been the major discussion we've had here. How much of that's available sitting out on the market right now? And if I want to go and bring a glass company up here and comply with this thing, if I had a reasonable assumption that I could immediately get into the market, then there'd be plenty of supply out there for me to order.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, when you think about what the recycling rate is for glass, and we do our garbage studies where we sort through the landfill to determine how much recycling is occurring, more than half of the clear glass is ending up in the landfill. We can make enormous strides in clear glass. The landfill studies are interesting, and maybe sometime I should come back to have more time to talk about it.
I just asked a simple question. Mm-hmm. I am not concerned about what's out in the landfill. That doesn't have anything to do with Owens Corning. Why is Owens Corning being made the sipping boy for those of us that aren't convinced that it's reasonable to recycle clear glass, myself among them? By the time I purchase all the equipment and stuff that it takes me to keep all those things sorted, by the time I take all the time it takes me, by the time I take all the hot water to wash the thing out, by the time I get so sick and tired of scraping my fingernails trying to get labels off and all this type of thing, separate the metal caps from them and all this, I don't figure I'm getting any kind of a bargain out of that. And I don't figure that clear glass is going to go anywhere. And if we really run into a time when we need it, we can mine those dumps and get that glass if it becomes that important. Now, if it were a little easier to do, and if they can develop some ways of doing it, Owens Corning should not be responsible for my unwillingness or any other person's unwillingness to take that in and do it when it's labor-intensive and when it's a nuisance for us to have to do, when it's product wasting. How many jars do you have to recycle to afford to be making all these Rubbermaid containers and everything else to warrant the use of that material? There's a big thing behind this. I mean, you're using them as a whipping boy and trying to make them do it. I'm tired of coming back every session and having to deal with the same thing. You're not getting it solved. It's coming back to us time after time after time. You say you've been involved in it since 90. You understand you can work with them and all that kind of stuff, but that's not happening. It's right back here before us again. I'd like to get this thing settled. I am convinced that these people will buy the cullet if it's available. If it isn't available, they're going to have to do something else, and they shouldn't have to go around Robin Hood's barn and do a whole bunch of justification to a whole bunch of agencies and people in order to get this done.
Bob, did you want to? You're okay. Okay. Third of well. Thank you very much.
Doug Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm representing the Association of Oregon Recyclers. Oregon Recyclers is a nonprofit organization of businesses such as Weyerhaeuser and very small businesses like Cloudburst Recycling in Portland. Individuals and others. I've given you kind of a folder there, what I call a cheat sheet, which I'll hold over him, that gives us some information. And I have to tell you that I've been out in the hall talking with Mark Nelson and the fellow from Los Angeles, and we're willing to work with them. You're looking at kind of a third-string hitter in me tonight because AOR is having a board meeting, and so all the people that really know something about this are in a room someplace. But I do want to say that we will work with the Glass Package Institute to come to some sort of an accommodation and work with their specific problems that they do have. But we do, AOR is opposed to the bill as currently written, and we expect that it will be...
On what basis?
As in my testimony, it tells about the three things the bill does. The first thing that we don't like is say that glass containers manufactured outside of Oregon will only have to meet the minimum recycled content law in that state. California has a 35% recycled content law, as we do at the moment, but Washington has nothing. Second thing is that GPI proposes to reduce the 50% content label for the year 2000 down to 35%. Third thing is the technologically infeasible based on the existing equipment and manufacturing requirements of the manufacturer thing that's in the bill. Those are the three things that we object to, and we think we can work with the GPI to come up with something to address their specific problem.
Jim? Brenda Fisher. Am I totally dense? Didn't I just hear that Owens Corning supports this bill? Everybody's coming up here so worried about Owens Corning being able to compete and all of this kind of stuff, and yet if I thought I just heard that Owens Corning supported this bill.
Senator George, Senator Fisher, I don't know if I heard that too, but Owens Corning, well, like a lot of my people, are not here tonight, so I can't speak for them.
But I didn't ask you to speak for them. I thought I heard somebody speak for them other than you that said this, and yet out of the goodness of heart, everybody else is saying they can't compete with out-of-state people. This is not making any sense to me. But they come and tell me that they'd like to get all the pellets they can get because it's easier on the furnaces, it's easier in every way. I don't have a problem with the fact that apparently they're already at the 50% or something. It almost sounded like they'd be plenty willing to do it if they could get it in available quantities to continue with it. They didn't, in the testimony about them, there was nothing said about them. Worry about being able to compete with out-of-state people. You know, there's there's something wrong in Denmark or someplace. Closer than Denmark, that's why either that or my ears are totally bad.
Mr. Chair,
I don't understand it.
Senator Fisher, at the time, I think Owens Corning is a member of AOR. I don't know about the Glass Packaging Institute, if they are or not. We have a lot of big outfits that are members of the corporate, and they're, again, they're not here to tell you what they think. And again, Senator, I have to tell you, I know what it's like to be a member of an association. You have differing things. I can tell you, in my experience right now, as the lobbyist for the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, having to do with 1149, the energy dereg bill, there's a lot of differences that go on, but you do things for the good of the coalition. But again, they're not here to testify on the bill. I can't speak for them.
Okay, good. Well, yes, Senator Fisher?
I was saying, I don't know anything about California or Gallo or anything. I can't speak to that, but I would only say that it hasn't been my observation that California is much worried about some expenses around certain aspects of environmental protection issues, when it gets involved with automobiles, things like that. It seems like they'll go to no end, so expensive on their people and stuff like that. They paid a pretty heavy price here not too long ago, popped out of their state. Unfortunately, there was such a carbon copy of them, and we have a lot greater percentage of them than we did. That they may be able to do something like that. What expense? You know, anything about the expenses costing Gallup get those jugs, or what those that company's having to go through in order to do that? These are things that are missing out of my judgment equation on this whole process, and I've been in business long enough that I'm suspect of these things automatically, unless I can be showed in black and shown in black and white, and not red ink, how these things fit together. So I have certainly appreciate getting some more information about some of these statements here. Set my mind at ease that there is even a possibility of being enough, call it, under the circumstances, the fact that we're not going to make a whipping boy for people that aren't satisfied or aren't educated to the point or aren't given the decision yet that it's worth any great effort to be saving clear glass.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I have to tell you that the recyclers are very proud of what Owens has been doing and will continue to do right here, and they've been very conscientious. Speaking for Gallo, I can't speak for Gallo at all. It's a closed corporation, but I do believe they do make a lot of money. That's just a personal observation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not talking about Gallo. I'm talking about the company that's been.
That is my assumption, yes.
They might also be able to do a few things like that where they're able to fill in the jugs and all that. They maybe have a little handle on accepting some greater businesses and working them out through another business that others don't have either.
Doug, it's almost a startling similarity between the three letters of Osberg, City of Portland, and your association. I mean, the words are almost exactly the same. So I'm going to ask you this question on behalf of the City of Portland, and that is, what do you think about requiring them to sort?
Mr. Chair, I know the co-minimum thing is a real hot item, and I don't believe AOR has taken a position on that. You have to, again, I really wish that somebody from AOR were here to tell you more about if it is being, could be being discussed at this very moment. I have no idea. But I hear what I'm going to relay what you all you have said onto the AOR board, and you'll be heard.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll assume from what we've heard that all involved parties
will be working on this. We're going to go ahead and draw some of the amendments we see. Please, if you would, contact Brad at the earliest convenience with amendments. And if I could ask everyone that this happens considerable amount of time in this building, and that if you have a problem with a bill and you believe that the bill is salvageable and the person that brought the bill might in fact have a point, could we draw up a set of amendments? We'd be happy to work with you that would make the bill workable rather than coming and just opposing the bill. Okay, very good. Thank you for listening to my sermon. Thank you, Senator Fisher. Go ahead. Yes, sir, I am.
I'm the same way. It bothers me when somebody comes in here and tells they have a working relationship with somebody, and we face the same thing for 3-4 stations running. And I, too, get a little tired of that. Legislative process should be the last means of settling these items, and when they keep coming up and keep cropping up here in front of us, there's a time I want to put them back. I'm after 8 years, basically, on a subject that's not progress being made, that's going to get something done so we don't.
Good end of the sermon. Thank you. All right. If there is no further discussion on Senate Bill 940, I'm going to tap the gavel and close the public hearing, and with that, we will be adjourned.